Democrats seem to run every metropolis in America. New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Philadelphia, San Francisco, they run them all. And it's not just blue state cities. Houston, Phoenix, and Nashville, all in red states, but all run by the left. Atlanta hasn't had a Republican mayor since 1879. And for New Orleans, you have to go all the way back to 1872 to find a GOP mayor. Out of the top 25 most populated cities in America, only two are run by Republicans. How did that happen? How did Democrats take over American cities? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
Today, it seems to be a given that Democrats run all of America's major cities. People don't even think twice about it. If it's a big metropolis, it's almost always run by a Democrat. How did that happen? How did the left take over America's major cities? To find the answer, we're going to tell the story of how a Wall Street analyst inadvertently poked a powerful syndicate. A syndicate that slowly helped Democrats control just about every major city in the country.
She probably didn't even realize it at the time, but Meredith Whitney was about to awaken a strange beast, one that feeds off unsuspecting city dwellers. It was September 2010, and everyone was on edge.
The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend. Lehman Brothers, a 158-year-old firm, filed for bankruptcy.
The shock of the financial crisis still lingered, and people were wondering what was going to be the next shoe to drop. Banking analyst Meredith Whitney thought she knew.
We looked around, and there was nothing available to tell you about this process of state budgeting, how monies are transferred. It reminded me, the state situation reminded me so much of the banks pre-crisis.
That's Meredith.
So in other words, you believe that the fiscal challenges facing the states right now could be the next systemic risk for the financial system and for the economy.
There's no doubt about it. And the similarities between the states and the banks are extreme.
By her calculation, cities and states were in big trouble. They were spending far more money than was coming in. And municipal bonds, the debt vehicle they used to cover the deficit, were looking like they could trigger the next financial crisis. It was a dire prediction, and the finance world took notice, because when Meredith Whitney spoke, Wall Street listened. And why? Well, she was one of the first to sound the alarm on the 2008 financial crisis, almost a year before it happened. She looked like a fortune teller. So in September 2010, when Meredith predicted the finances of cities and states were going to be the next catastrophe, big money had to take her seriously. Her warning made a splash throughout the financial industry, and media wanted to hear more.
Meredith, your latest report, really fascinating. Tragedy of the Commons launching ratings on states. And what you've said is that the states remind you of the banks pre-crisis. I mean, this is serious.
Well, she made a name for herself when she correctly forecast the problems at Citigroup. Now analyst Meredith Whitney is zeroing in on the problems plaguing the states.
Her message was getting some traction, but the stock market hadn't yet reacted. It would take the 2010 midterms to trigger a response.
CNN that can now project the Republicans will have a net gain of 39 seats, at least 39 seats. They will become the majority in the House of Representatives.
With the Republicans winning the House, it became evident that Obama's stimulus checks were about to dry up. And that was a problem, because it was those checks that were propping up city and state finances. If the White House stopped helping local governments, could they make the payments on their loans? The question spooked Wall Street. Maybe Meredith Whitney was right. So in-the-know investors began selling the municipal bonds that carried those loans.
We're going to focus right now on the municipal bond market. Take a look at this chart. Prices for municipal bond securities have taken a nosedive. Prices have fallen off about 10% since hitting a high at the end of August.
Bond prices plummeted. But even with the sell-off, Meredith Whitney's message was only reaching the finance world. It hadn't yet hit Main Street. That day would arrive in December 2010.
By now, just about everyone in the country is aware of the federal deficit problem. But you should know that there is another financial crisis looming involving state and local governments.
60 Minutes ran a segment entitled The Day of Reckoning, and it told the story of the precarious financial condition of state and local governments that could lead to the next financial crisis.
The states have been getting by on billions of dollars in federal stimulus funds, but the day of reckoning is at hand. The debt crisis is already making Wall Street nervous, and some believe that it could derail the recovery, cost a million public employees their jobs, and require another big bailout package that no one in Washington wants to talk about.
With the nation still shell-shocked from the banking crisis, the report's warning was ominous and sounded all too familiar. Meredith Whitney took center stage on the show.
Meredith Whitney is one of the most respected financial analysts on Wall Street and one of the most influential women in American business. Now she's warning about a financial meltdown in state and local governments.
I think next to housing, this is the single most important issue in the United States and certainly the largest threat to the U.S. economy.
The report highlighted some of the worst states.
California, which faces a $19 billion budget deficit next year, has a credit rating approaching junk status. It now spends more money on public employee pensions than it does on the state university system.
All the interviews were compelling, but it was Meredith Whitney that delivered the quote that drew out a strange beast from hiding.
Whitney believes the states will find a way to honor their debts, but she's afraid that some local governments, which depend on their state for a third of their revenues, will get squeezed as the states are forced to tighten their belts. She's convinced that some cities and counties will be unable to meet their obligations to municipal bondholders who finance their debt.
There's not a doubt in my mind that you will see a spate of municipal bond defaults.
How many is a spate?
You could see 50 sizable defaults, 50 to 100 sizable defaults, more. This will amount to hundreds of billions of dollars worth of defaults.
And what was the timing on this building crisis?
It'll be something to worry about within the next 12 months.
12 months.
12 months.
The Day of Reckoning was viewed by 18 million Americans, and the show immediately ignited a media firestorm.
One of the people predicting a tough year for munis is analyst Meredith Whitney. These days, Whitney is focusing on munis, and she says there will be as many as 100 significant muni bond defaults this coming year, totaling hundreds of billions of dollars. It's a bold call for sure.
So will the federal government come to the rescue? Just how freaked out should you be about a muni meltdown?
According to Meredith Whitney, a prominent market research analyst, a new disaster is looming. She's warned that as many as 100 U.S. cities face default on their municipal bonds. So are we about to see the next bubble burst?
Meanwhile, over 100 American cities could go bankrupt in 2011 as the debt crisis threatens to spark a municipal meltdown. That is according to the U.S. research analyst Meredith Whitney, who correctly predicted the global credit crunch. New York City, Detroit, San Francisco, and Los Angeles are among the cities feared to go bust in 2011.
It wasn't long before a legion of peculiar detractors came out to attack Meredith Whitney, and they came from all angles.
Frankly, she's dead wrong.
I not only disagree, I think her comments are irresponsible.
Could or would a state default? Not really.
The idea that there would be hundreds of billions of dollars worth of default, that's unquantifiable.
It's an absurdity.
I disagree, though, that there are going to be widespread municipal defaults.
Her prediction was called ludicrous and irresponsible, with one municipal bond veteran claiming that, quote,
"To be talking about massive defaults is the equivalent of talking about meteors, the downfall of Rome, and the end of Western civilization."
The day after the broadcast, one of the most powerful public employee unions in America, AFSCME, shot off a video demanding Meredith stop the lies. The man in charge of California's accounting published an op-ed saying, California isn't broken. And a representative from the largest municipal bond fund said Meredith's analysis wasn't worth the paper it was written on. In the weeks that followed, the municipal bond market was rattled by a massive investor sell-off. Political pundits started debating a state bankruptcy option, which would be an unprecedented move because states can't claim bankruptcy. The Securities Exchange Commission was reported to be monitoring Meredith Whitney, and even a House Oversight Committee requested her appearance at a hearing. When she declined, the chairman suggested they might force her to appear.
Are muni bonds the next big crisis for this country? Congress is investigating in a hearing today on Capitol Hill.
Did you look at Meredith Whitney's report that she declined to make public, only gave it to some of her clients?
No, I've yet to see the report. We have not had access to that. But if you'd like to share it with me, I'd be happy to take a look.
Well, see, that's why you should bring her in front of you. It's not because we want her opinion. We want to know the facts upon which she based her opinion. That's the reason to subpoena her, not for her opinion, for what data she supposedly has.
Or lack thereof.
The financial analyst was being intimidated. Watching the whole thing play out in real time, you have to ask yourself, what just happened? How could this one woman, in the course of a single televised interview, ignite a media firestorm that would shake the entire financial market, panic Congress, anger government officials, and trigger an attack by public sector unions? Nothing she said was really that controversial. Everyone knew cities and states were in massive debt. Well, it all happened because Meredith Whitney exposed the grift of a syndicate that feeds off the people of Gotham, the same syndicate that helped Democrats take over almost every major metropolitan area in America. This syndicate is comprised of everyone that makes money off government spending. City, state, and county employees, government contractors, municipal bond brokers, the fund managers and investment bankers of these bonds, and of course, politicians. These municipal grifters make up the Muni Syndicate. And over the course of half a century, they've been pulling out so much cash from cities and states that they've plunged them into massive debt. To give you an idea of how much money this syndicate has drained from our coffers, in 1975, local and state governments were $235.4 billion in debt through muni bonds. Today, that number has risen to roughly $4 trillion. How did this muni syndicate form? Where did it get its power? And how did it help Democrats take over major cities? The answer to these questions can be boiled down to three words: public sector unions.
By the mid-20th century, public sector unions were considered the weakling offspring of the labor movement. To get an idea of how minuscule their power was at the time, in 1955, public sector unions had 400,000 members. That same year, private sector unions' membership exceeded 15 million. The primary reason for this difference in size was that, unlike their private sector cousins, public employee unions were lacking a key ingredient, a thing called collective bargaining. Basically, collective bargaining allows a representative to negotiate with an employer the salary, benefits, and working conditions of all their employees. Prior to the late 1950s, allowing collective bargaining in the public sector was considered a recipe for disaster. Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was considered a friend of the labor movement, famously stated, quote, "The process of collective bargaining, as usually understood, cannot be transplanted into the public service," end quote. Even George Meany, former president of the massive AFL-CIO labor union, claimed, "It is impossible to bargain with the government." There was a consensus. Public sector unions should not be allowed to collectively bargain. And why? Well, imagine this scenario. You're working at a company and you don't like your pay, healthcare, and retirement benefits. So you march into your boss's office and say, "I want more." Your boss looks at his budget and calmly responds that he can't do it. There's a back and forth, and he eventually tells you to get lost. So you go out to the city and find someone that agrees to give you what you want, even if the company can't afford it. You shake hands with this guy, then you tell hundreds of thousands of your coworkers to vote for this new guy, and he becomes your boss. And the old boss that was trying to be responsible with the company's money, he's out. That is what collective bargaining is like for public sector unions. In essence, they're given the power to hire and fire their own boss. This is why even progressive leaders in the mid-20th century agreed that public unions should not be allowed to collectively bargain. But that perspective was not shared by all. Enter the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME for short. Formed in the 1930s, AFSCME was the lead advocate of collective bargaining for public sector unions. On February 13, 1957, they had a breakthrough. They convinced the Democrat mayor of Philadelphia, Richardson Dilworth, to make a radical announcement. Philadelphia now steps forward as the first large American city to adopt for its non-office workers and white-collar employees what has been the rule in private industry, exclusive bargaining rights in one majority union. I am sure that the city and the general public will benefit tremendously from the pioneering move we have made this day. The contract covered 15,000 city employees, and the exclusive contract to bargain was granted to AFSCME. A citywide action of this size was unprecedented. The Philadelphia mayor gave birth to a beast. This development spread to New York City, right into the hands of a rising AFSCME organizer named Jerry Wirth.
It is important to understand that at the time we took power, the union was conservative in stance, although, orthodox liberal in resolutions that were adopted at meetings.
That's Jerry Wirth. Jerry was a brash, tireless union organizer and radical socialist that wanted to change the positioning of his public sector union, AFSCME.
The union also had no importance on the American scene. Not many people knew us. Not only did we have a clumsy name, but, we had no real impact. In any event, when we took power, things began to change. The union, when we took power, was white, Anglo-Saxon, probably Protestant, in the cities, ethnically divided, mostly Catholic. The thing is that this crowd took over, and we began to reshape the union. At that time, we couldn't reshape it structurally. We needed another convention, but we began to reshape it philosophically.
Jerry had an ambitious goal. He didn't want to just bring collective bargaining to the Big Apple. He wanted union membership dues automatically taken out of New York City employees' paychecks, whether they liked it or not. But in the 1950s, the New York legislature was predominantly conservative, and he knew he'd never reach his goals through a Republican mayor. The socialists would have to align with the Democrats. So in the lead-up to the 1953 mayoral election, Jerry turned to a promising Democrat contender by the name of Robert F. Wagner Jr. He targeted this guy because his dad wrote the seminal legislation that brought collective bargaining to all private sector workers. To put him on the spot, Jerry asked the candidate to address AFSCME union members during his run for the mayor. Wagner accepted and fell right into Jerry's trap. You see, in his youth, Jerry was a member of the Young People's Socialist League, so he understood the power of agitation. He made sure that every AFSCME member that could be rounded up was in attendance. The Democrat mayoral candidate arrived to a Midtown Manhattan hotel bursting at the seams with union members, and several thousand more spilling into the streets. Jerry cornered the candidate and had two primary questions for him. Would he issue an executive order extending collective bargaining to New York City employees? And would he allow union dues to be automatically taken from city's workers' paychecks? With the overwhelming headcount at the event, the candidate made a political calculation and agreed to both requests, if he was elected mayor. This moment signaled the future dynamic of union negotiations. Give us what we want, or we'll elect a different boss. AFSCME would go on to help get Robert Wagner Jr. elected, and in March 1958, Mayor Wagner signed Executive Order 49 that gave the union everything they asked for. A year and a half later, AFSCME pushed Democrat Wisconsin Governor Gaylord Nelson to sign the first statewide legislation allowing collective bargaining for the public employees of Wisconsin. The trend spread to other states over the coming years. The public sector unions were developing a business model, aligned with Democrat politicians, and only Democrat politicians because the unions were run by socialists, make the politician promise to deliver goodies to union members, get the politician elected, receive the goodies, then repeat the process all over again when the politician's term was up. If a candidate wouldn't commit to their demands, they would have an exponentially harder time getting elected. And if, say, a mayor didn't have enough in the budget to deliver higher wages or platinum benefits or increased jobs, they simply asked the public for a loan by issuing municipal bonds. This little arrangement worked swimmingly. For about a decade and a half after collective bargaining spread to parts of the country, the size of public sector unions exploded. From a paltry 400,000 members in 1955, membership grew to 4 million by the 1970s. An astounding growth rate by any measure. And as union membership grew, they drove up the city's budgets and debt, which grew union membership, which in turn grew government budgets and debt, and on in a never-ending feedback loop. Until one city was pushed to the biggest financial crisis it had faced since the Great Depression.
Near the end of 1974, New York City's finances were in dire straits. For roughly a decade and a half, the city had been spending more than it had been taking in, due in large part to the promises politicians made to the public sector unions. To make up the budget deficit, New York City turned to issuing municipal bonds to borrow money from the public. These muni bonds, as they're called, were attractive to cautious investors because they're very low risk. Cities rarely go bankrupt, and that's because they avoid missing the debt payment on their muni bonds at all costs for one simple reason. If they don't pay back these loans, they'd have a much harder time borrowing in the future. Many state and local governments place the payment of bond debt above almost all other expenditures. In the case of California, for example, paying bond debt has priority over all other budget items except education. Well, for years, the Big Apple was taking on debt like a drunken socialite at a shoe sale. People began questioning the city's ability to pay its debts, and the New York Times wasn't making things easier for the mayor. The newspaper ran an article headlined, "Near Bankrupt City." The Democrat mayor, Abraham Beam, responded, issuing a statement stating, quote,
"Bankruptcy means that liabilities exceed assets or that credit obligations cannot be met. A situation in which the city of New York, even in the darkest days of the Great Depression, never has found itself, nor will it."
But nobody was buying his spin. Not long after, city officials arrived at a regular meeting to issue bonds to the public. They needed to borrow money. New York City's financial controller announced the investment opportunity.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today, the city of New York is offering for competitive bidding sale 260 million tax anticipation notes, of which 100 million will mature on June 3, 1975.
The banks were supposed to arrive at 11 a.m. to buy the bonds, which they would in turn sell to the public. But the banks were all a no-show. The meeting was rescheduled for 3 hours later. But then 2 p.m. arrived, then 2:30, then 2:45 p.m. The banks, again, didn't show up.
The announcement on behalf of the controller is that the offer, which we had expected to receive and announce at 2 o'clock this afternoon, is now expected at 4 o'clock.
Well, does this mean that so far nobody wants those bonds?
We will be making a further announcement at 4 o'clock, and anything further that I could say now, I think, would not advance the interests of the sale, which is now in progress.
Does this mean that you have not been able to sell them so far today?
We will have a further announcement at 4 o'clock.
The city's finances were on the verge of a collapse, and the banks knew it. They didn't show up because they were concerned that if they got involved with the city's bond offering, they could possibly be criminally liable. Only 33% of these bonds were sold, leaving the city in a position to default on its debt the next month. But the bad news was just beginning. Adding a devastating blow to the city, Standard & Poor's suspended its rating for New York City bonds, sending a message to the public that the Big Apple could actually be going bankrupt. 2 days later, as a last resort, the state of New York announced it would lend the city $400 million to help it get through the next few weeks. Things were getting so bad in the Big Apple that local stores were offering discounts to unpaid city workers.
We're here with the press and bond stores, where Bonds has just announced a new concept in a self-help program for the city.
All right, the idea is very simple. If Washington can't come through, if Albany is hesitant, then at least we who do business in New York can help those people who help us be the city we are.
Believing the New York City municipal employee shouldn't take the brunt of our budget crisis.
And he sure shouldn't.
Bonds will give each and every city employee a 10% discount to help cut his cost of living right now.
Right, and if other retailers take up this banner, then all of us will benefit by helping those who help us, like the policemen and firemen, the teachers, the sanitation men, the hospital employees.
All those municipal employees who work for the biggest and still greatest city in America.
With the state coffers nearly running dry, New York City's mayor made the trek to the nation's capital to plead for help.
New York's Mayor Abraham Beame led a delegation of fellow mayors to Washington today, seeking federal financial aid for New York.
15 mayors, most from big cities, appealed to the Congressional Joint Economic Committee today for some federal emergency help for New York City, arguing that a New York default would hurt every other city in the country by making it impossible for other cities to borrow money.
The state has done all it can. The city has done and is committed to do more of what we've done. And if the federal government does not help us, I think it will find the problem afterwards, which it would have to help us with, much more serious.
The mayor's asked for federal guarantees for New York City bonds and notes, and if necessary, emergency loans. The first answer from the Ford administration was a loud, firm no.
The costs and risks associated with any program to provide special federal financial assistance to prevent default substantially outweigh the benefits which prevention would provide.
With the Big Apple's financial position becoming more and more compromised, the city was faced with defaulting on its debt by the close of business on Friday, October 18, 1975. And the media was doing its part to scare politicians into action.
Governor Hugh Carey of New York told Congress today that default by New York City would be an economic Pearl Harbor for the rest of the nation.
West German Chancellor Schmidt came here and said the collapse of the world's financial capital could push the whole world back into recession.
New York City is right on the edge of financial disaster this morning, and this time, as they said at Pearl Harbor, it's no drill.
The biggest problem, trustees of union pension funds were reluctant to lend the city money. Earlier, state unions had won a court case against using their pension funds to bail the city out. And yesterday, the city's teachers union joined in that refusal. So early this morning, Felix Rowatton, the city financier trying to raise the money to pay the city's bills today, $450 million worth, came out to say that he couldn't do it.
I'm sorry to have to tell you that the teachers' pension system has voted against making the commitment to us.
And there is no further change at 7 o'clock. Does this mean New York will default tomorrow?
I would think if this stands, the likelihood is very great that we will default tomorrow.
Default, if it comes, will in its first stage mean that $453 million of city debts borrowed exactly 1 year ago will not be paid back as they are supposed to be when the banks open at 9 a.m. Eastern Time this morning. But even if default doesn't come today, it's apparent now that it's not very far off unless there's major financial help from the federal government very quickly.
There is a risk, said Felix Rowatton last night or early this morning, that part of the payroll won't be met, and then suddenly some city workers aren't going to be working, and then it's very hard to tell. If sanitation men don't work or don't get paid, will they work? If city services are cut back, what will happen? Is there a risk of social disorder? Would National Guardsmen have to be brought in? And once the services are cut off, then no one knows just how badly people will be hurt. The end result, said one banker, is that New York could turn into a Calcutta.
Wow.
Under tremendous pressure, the trustees of the City Teachers Union Pension Fund agreed to invest $150 million into city bonds just hours before the Big Apple defaulted. But this only bought the city a few weeks. So the Democrat governor of New York went on the offense to pressure President Ford into a bailout.
Governor Kerry charged the real bankruptcy was not in New York, but in the presidential leadership of Gerald Ford.
It is only by sitting on their hands that the federal treasury stands to lose hundreds of millions of tax revenues if the city defaults.
President Ford shot back.
As we work with the wonderful people of New York to overcome their difficulties, and they will, we must never forget what brought this great center of human civilization to the brink. If we go on spending more than we have, providing more benefits and more services than we can pay for, then a day of reckoning will come to Washington and the whole country, just as it has to New York City. And so, let me conclude with one question of my own. When that day of reckoning comes, who will bail out the United States of America?
The media and high-profile New York Democrats continue to tag-team attack on President Ford. The day after he rejected a bailout of the Big Apple, the New York Daily News ran with the famous headline, "Ford to City, Drop Dead." The New York Post and the New York Times ran with front page, above the fold headlines shaming Ford into action. Then, New York's governor jumped back into the ring.
"I am here tonight to say that I agree with Gerald Ford. Washington should not bail out New York. It's also true that the undeniable dislike of many Americans for the cultural climate of New York makes intelligent debate very difficult. But I still believe that if Americans understand what New York is really asking for, they will support it, not because they love the city, and certainly not because they want to pay the cost of past mistakes. They will support it because it will save them money. This is the single most important fact that the White House chooses to ignore. The loan guarantee plan now before Congress does not give New York City one red cent. It gives the city time to pay its debts and reform its practices. There is a sorry history of reckless fiscal policy in New York City going back years, perhaps decades, and there is blame enough for everyone. City officials and interest groups, banks that did not ask the hard questions, a state legislature, and a governor, now Mr. Ford's hand-picked vice president, that specifically authorized every fringe and pension benefit and every unwise borrowing Mr. Ford now attacks so righteously."
New York City's financial crisis reached a peak in November 1975. By mid-month, what was said could never happen, happened. New York State passed legislation halting the payment of its debt for 3 years. In essence, New York City was defaulting on its debt. About a week later, the state scraped together even more cash for the Big Apple to avoid bankruptcy. But national public opinion began to shift. Many feared that a New York City default could spread to their city. With the heightened fear taking its toll, and just 1 year away from an election, President Ford finally relented on Thanksgiving Eve, 1975.
"I have decided to ask the Congress, when it returns from recess, for authority to provide a temporary line of credit to the state of New York to enable it to supply seasonal financing of essential services for the people of New York City. New York officials must continue to accept primary responsibility. There must be no misunderstanding of my position."
The Democrat New York City mayor got his bailout.
"The president's action, crucial as it may be, does not bring our serious difficulties to an end. The coming months and years will mean new sacrifices for all New Yorkers."
The crisis that many felt stemmed from public sector unions had come to a close. City leaders all across the country learned that they can continue their financial scheme with their local muni syndicate because Washington, D.C. would eventually bail them out. One of the key members of New York City's muni syndicate was asked about his takeaway from the Big Apple's 1975 financial crisis. He responded saying, quote, "A seawall is all stronger for having been repaired." And he was right. Their grift did get stronger, and their hold over major cities has grown ever since. From 1975 to 2021, the powerful municipal syndicate has grown state and local government debt by a jaw-dropping 1,700%. And in the process, they help their Democrat figureheads take over the major cities that line their pockets. Which leads us back to the question, how did Democrats take over American cities? The answer is, they became the figureheads of a powerful syndicate, a municipal syndicate designed to extract money from city budgets. This financial alliance, led by the public sector unions, has created a near impenetrable force for Republicans in every major city in America. They use the money they pull from city coffers to grow their numbers, then use those numbers to hire their own boss. And because the ringleaders of this muni syndicate are socialists, the bosses they successfully hire are always Democrats. You may think this cartel is too small to impact elections, but you'd be wrong in that assumption. The bigger the city, the bigger the Muni Syndicate, and they're some of the most politically active people in America. They volunteer for campaigns, become poll workers, count Election Day ballots, donate to campaigns, and protest at the home of a local politician they want replaced. They've turned just about every major city in America blue. Financial analyst Meredith Whitney inadvertently uncovered this Muni Syndicate when she sounded the alarm on the debt they were creating. Her prediction didn't come true. City bankruptcies did not become the next financial crisis. But the thing about predictions is that it's all about the timing.
Federal government was very quick to bail out the banks a decade ago. No questions asked. Federal government was very quick to bail out the auto industry. How about bailing out the nation's largest city? How about bailing out the epicenter of this crisis where people have been suffering? That is what our federal government should do.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Thanks for listening.